I could see that its wall panels were molded from graffiti-resistant fiberglass. I could see its twin strips of advertisements running away from me where the wall panels met the roof. I could see small, cheerful posters touting television shows and language instruction and easy college degrees and major earning opportunities. I could see a police notice advising me, "If you see something, say something." The nearest passenger to me was a Hispanic woman. She was across the car from me, on my left, forward of the first set of doors, all alone on a bench built for eight, well off-center. She was small, somewhere between 30 and 50, and she looked very hot and very tired. She had a well-worn supermarket bag looped over her wrist, and she was staring across at the empty place opposite with eyes too weary to be seeing much. Next up was a man on the other side, maybe 4 feet farther down the car. He was all alone on his own eight-person bench. He could have been from the Balkans or the Black Sea. Dark hair, lined skin. He was sinewy, worn down by work and weather. He had his feet planted, and he was leaning forward with his elbows on his knees. Not asleep, but close to it. Suspended animation. Marking time, rocking with the movements of the train. He was about 50, dressed in clothes far too young for him, baggy jeans that reached only his calves, and an oversized NBA shirt with a player's name on it that I didn't recognize. Third up was a woman who might have been West African. She was on the left, south of the center doors. Tired, inert, her black skin made dusty and gray by fatigue and the lights. She was wearing a colorful batik dress with a matching square of cloth tied over her hair. Her eyes were closed. I know New York reasonably well. I call myself a citizen of the world, and New York the capital of the world, so I can make sense of the city the same way a Brit knows London or a Frenchman knows Paris. I'm familiar but not intimate with its habits. But it was an easy guess that any three people like these, already seated on a late-night northbound 6 train south of Bleecker, were office cleaners heading home from evening shifts around City Hall, or restaurant service workers from Chinatown or Little Italy. They were probably set for Hunts Point in the Bronx, or maybe all the way up to Pelham Bay, ready for short, fitful sleeps before more long days. The fourth and the fifth passengers were different. The fifth was a man. He was maybe my age, wedged at 45 degrees on the two-person bench diagonally opposite me, all the way across and down the length of the car. He was dressed casually, but not cheaply. Chinos and a golf shirt. He was awake. His eyes were fixed somewhere in front of him. Their focus changed and narrowed constantly, like he was alert and speculating. They reminded me of a ballplayer's eyes. They had a certain canny, calculating shrewdness in them. But it was passenger number 4 that I was looking at. "If you see something, say something." She was seated on the right side of the car, all alone on the farther 8-person bench, across from and about halfway between the exhausted West African woman and the guy with the ballplayer's eyes. She was white, and probably in her 40s. She was plain. She had black hair, neatly but unstylishly cut, and too uniformly dark to be natural. She was dressed all in black. I could see her fairly well. The guy nearest to me on the right was still sitting forward, and the V-shaped void between his bent back and the wall of the car made my line of sight uninterrupted, except for a forest of stainless steel grab bars. Not a perfect view, but good enough to ring every bell on the 11-point list. The bullet headings lit up like cherries on a Vegas machine. According to Israeli counterintelligence, I was looking at a suicide bomber. Chapter 2. I dismissed the thought immediately. Not because of racial profiling. White women are as capable of craziness as anyone else. I dismissed the thought because of tactical implausibility. The timing was wrong. The New York subway would make a fine target for a suicide bombing. The 6 train would be as good as any other, and better than most. It stops under Grand Central Terminal. 8 in the morning, 6 at night, a crowded car, 40 seated, 148 standing, wait until the doors open on packed platforms, push the button. 100 dead, a couple of 100 grievously injured, panic, infrastructure damage, possibly fire, a major transportation hub shut down for days or weeks, and maybe never really trusted again. A significant score for people whose heads work in ways we can't quite understand. But not at 2 o'clock in the morning. Not in a car holding just 6 people. Not when Grand Central subway platforms would hold only drifting trash and empty cups and a couple of old homeless guys on benches. The train stopped at Astor Place. The doors hissed open. No one got on. No one got off. The doors thumped shut again, and the motors whined, and the train moved on. The bullet points stayed lit up. The first was the obvious no-brainer. Inappropriate clothing. By now, explosive belts are as evolved as baseball gloves. Take a 3-foot by 2-foot sheet of heavy canvas, fold once longitudinally, and you have a continuous pocket a foot deep. Wrap the pocket around the bomber and sew it together in back. Zippers or snaps can lead to second thoughts. Insert a stockade of dynamite sticks into the pocket all the way around. Wire them up, pack nails or ball bearings into the voids, sew the top seam shut, add crude shoulder straps to take the weight. Altogether effective, but altogether bulky. The only practical concealment, an oversized garment like a padded winter parka, never appropriate in the Middle East, and plausible in New York maybe 3 months in 12. But this was September, and it was as hot as summer, and 10 degrees hotter underground. I was wearing a T-shirt. Passenger number 4 was wearing a North Face down jacket, black, puffy, shiny, a little too large, and zipped to her chin. If you see something, say something. I took a pass on the second of the 11 points, not immediately applicable. The second point is a robotic walk. Significant at a checkpoint or in a crowded marketplace or outside a church or a mosque, but not relevant with a seated suspect on public transportation. Bombers walk robotically, not because they're overcome with ecstasy at the thought of imminent martyrdom, but because they're carrying 40 extra pounds of unaccustomed weight, which is biting into their shoulders through crude suspender straps, and because they're drugged. Martyrdom's appeal goes only so far. Most bombers are brow-beaten simpletons with a slug of raw opium paste held between gum and cheek. We know this because dynamite belts explode with a characteristic donut-shaped pressure wave that rolls up the torso in a fraction of a nanosecond and lifts the head clean off the shoulders. The human head isn't bolted on. It just rests there by gravity, somewhat tied down by skin and muscles and tendons and ligaments, but those insubstantial biological anchors don't do much against the force of a violent chemical explosion. My Israeli mentor told me the easiest way to determine that an open-air attack was caused by a suicide bomber rather than by a car bomb or a package bomb is to search on an 80 or 90-foot radius and look for a severed human head, which is likely to be strangely intact and undamaged, even down to the opium plug in the cheek. The train stopped at Union Square. No one got on. No one got off. Hot air billowed in from the platform and fought the interior air conditioning. Then the doors closed again and the train moved on. Points 3 through 6 are variations on a subjective theme. Irritability, sweating, tics, and nervous behavior. Although in my opinion, sweating is as likely to be caused by physical overheating as by nerves. The inappropriate clothing and the dynamite. Dynamite is wood pulp soaked with nitroglycerin and molded into baton-sized sticks. Wood pulp is a good thermal insulator, so sweating comes with the territory. But the irritability and the tics and the nervous behavior are valuable indicators. These people are in the last weird moments of their lives. Anxious, scared of pain, woozy with narcotics, they are irrational by definition. Believing or half-believing or not really believing at all in paradise and rivers of milk and honey and lush pastures and virgins, driven by ideological pressures or by the expectations of their peers and their families, suddenly in too deep and unable to back out. Brave talk in clandestine meetings is one thing. Action is another. Hence, suppressed panic with all its visible signs. Passenger number 4 was showing them all. She looked exactly like a woman heading for the end of her life, as surely and certainly as the train was heading for the end of the line. Therefore, point 7, breathing. She was panting, low and controlled, in, out, in, out, like a technique to conquer the pain of childbirth, or like the result of a ghastly shock, or like a last desperate barrier against screaming with dread and fear and terror. In, out, in, out. Point 8. Suicide bombers about to go into action stare rigidly ahead. No one knows why, but video evidence and surviving eyewitnesses have been entirely consistent in their reports. Bombers stare straight ahead. Perhaps they have screwed their commitment up to the sticking point and fear intervention. Perhaps, like dogs and children, they feel that if they're not seeing anyone, then no one is seeing them. Perhaps a last shred of conscience means they can't look at the people they're about to destroy. No one knows why, but they all do it. Passenger number 4 was doing it. That was for sure. She was staring across at the blank window opposite so hard she was almost burning a hole in the glass. Points 1 through 8. Check. I shifted my weight forward in my seat. Then I stopped. The idea was tactically absurd. The time was wrong. Then I looked again, and moved again, because points 9, 10, and 11 were all present and correct, too, and they were the most important points of all. Chapter 3. Point 9. Mumbled prayers. To date, all known attacks have been inspired or motivated or validated or invigilated by religion, almost exclusively the Islamic religion, and Islamic people are accustomed to praying in public. Surviving eyewitnesses report long, formulaic incantations run through and repeated endlessly and more or less inaudibly but with visibly moving lips. Passenger number 4 was really going at it. Her lips were moving below her fixed stare in a long, panting, ritualistic recitation that seemed to repeat itself every 20 seconds or so. Maybe she was already introducing herself to whatever deity she expected to meet on the other side of the line. Maybe she was trying to convince herself that there really was a deity and a line. The train stopped at 23rd Street. The doors opened. No one got off. No one got on. I saw the red exit signs above the platform, 22nd and Park, northeast corner, or 23rd and Park, southeast corner. Unremarkable lengths of Manhattan sidewalk, but suddenly attractive. I stayed in my seat. The doors closed. The train moved on. Point 10. A large bag. Dynamite is a stable explosive as long as it's fresh. It doesn't go off by accident. It needs to be triggered by blasting caps. Blasting caps are wired with detonator cord to an electricity supply and a switch. The big plungers in old Western movies were both things together. The first part of the handle's travel spun up a dynamo, like a field telephone, and then a switch was tripped. Not practical for portable use. For portable use, you need a battery, and for a linear yard of explosive, you need some volts and amps. Tiny AA cells put out a weak volt and a half. Not enough, according to prevailing rules of thumb. A 9-volt battery is better, and for a decent kick, you want one of the big square, soup can-sized cells sold for serious flashlights. Too big and too heavy for a pocket, hence the bag. The battery nestles in the bottom of the bag. Wires come off it to the switch, then they head on out through an unobtrusive slit in the back of the bag, and then they loop up under the hem of the inappropriate garment. Passenger number 4 was wearing a black canvas messenger bag, urban style, looped in front of one shoulder and behind the other and holed around into her lap. The way the stiff fabric bulged and sagged made it look empty, apart from a single heavy item. The train stopped at 28th Street. The doors opened. No one got on. No one got off. The doors closed and the train moved on. Point 11, hands in the bag. 20 years ago, point 11 was a recent addition. Previously, the list had ended at point 10, but things evolve. Action and then reaction. Israeli security forces and some brave members of the public had adopted a new tactic. If your suspicions were aroused, you didn't run. No point, really. You can't run faster than shrapnel. What you did instead was grab the suspect in a desperate bear hug. You pinned their arms to their sides. You stopped them reaching the button. Several attacks were prevented that way. Many lives were saved. But the bombers learned. Now they are taught to keep their thumbs on the button at all times, to make the bear hug irrelevant. The button is in the bag next to the battery, hence, hands in the bag. Passenger number 4 had her hands in her bag. The flap was bunched and creased between her wrists. The train stopped at 33rd Street. The doors opened. No one got off. A lone passenger on the platform hesitated and then stepped to her right and entered the next car. I turned and looked through the little window behind my head and saw her take a seat close to me. Two stainless bulkheads and the coupler space. I wanted to wave her away. She might survive at the other end of her car. But I didn't wave. We had no eye contact, and she would have ignored me anyway. I know New York. Crazy gestures on late-night trains carry no credibility. The doors stayed open a beat longer than normal. For a mad second, I thought of trying to shepherd everyone out. But I didn't. It would have been a comedy. Surprise, incomprehension, maybe language barriers. I wasn't sure that I knew the Spanish word for bomb. Bomba, maybe? Or was that light bulb? A crazy guy ranting about light bulbs wasn't going to help anyone. No, light bulb was bombilla, I thought. Maybe. Possibly. But certainly, I didn't know any Balkan languages, and I didn't know any West African dialects. Although maybe the woman in the dress spoke French. Some of West Africa is francophone, and I speak French. Une bombe. La femme là-bas a une bombe sous son manteau. The woman over there has a bomb under her coat. The woman in the dress might understand, or she might get the message some other way and simply follow us out. if she woke up in time, if she opened her eyes. In the end, I just stayed in my seat. The doors closed. The train moved on. I stared at passenger number 4, pictured her slim, pale thumb on the hidden button. The button probably came from Radio Shack, an innocent component for a hobby. Probably cost a buck and a half. I pictured a tangle of wires, red and black, taped and crimped and clamped, a thick detonator cord exiting the bag tucked under her coat, connecting 12 or 20 blasting caps in a long, lethal, parallel ladder. Electricity moves close to the speed of light. Dynamite is unbelievably powerful. In a closed environment like a subway car, the pressure wave alone would crush us all to paste. The nails and the ball bearings would be entirely gratuitous, like bullets against ice cream. Very little of us would survive. Bone fragments, maybe, the size of grape pits. Possibly the stirrup and the anvil from the inner ear might survive intact. They are the smallest bones in the human body, and therefore statistically the most likely to be missed by the shrapnel cloud. I stared at the woman. No way of approaching her. I was 30 feet away. Her thumb was already on the button. Cheap brass contacts were maybe an eighth of an inch apart, that tiny gap perhaps narrowing and widening fractionally and rhythmically as her heart beat and her arm trembled. She was good to go, and I wasn't. The train rocked onward with its characteristic symphony of sounds, the howl of rushing air in the tunnel, the thump and clatter of the expansion joints under the iron rims, the scrape of the current collector against the live rail, the whine of the motors, the sequential squeals as the cars lurched one after the other through curves and the wheel flanges bit down. Where was she going? What did the 6th train pass under? Could a building be brought down by a human bomb? I thought not. So what big crowds were still assembled after 2 o'clock in the morning? Not many. Nightclubs, maybe. But we had already left most of them behind, and she wouldn't get past a velvet rope anyway. I stared on at her. Too hard. She felt it. She turned her head, slowly, smoothly, like a pre-programmed movement. She stared right back at me. Our eyes met. Her face changed. She knew I knew. Chapter 4. We looked straight at each other for the best part of 10 seconds. Then I got to my feet, braced against the motion, and took a step. I would be killed 30 feet away, no question. I couldn't get any deader by being any closer. I passed the Hispanic woman on my left, passed the guy in the NBA shirt on my right, past the West African woman on my left. Her eyes were still closed. I handed myself from one grab bar to the next, left and right swaying. Passenger number 4 stared at me all the way, frightened, panting, muttering. Her hands stayed in her bag. I stopped 6 feet from her. I said, "I really want to be wrong about this." She didn't reply. Her lips moved, her hands moved under the thick black canvas. The large object in her bag shifted slightly. I said, "I need to see your hands." She didn't reply. "I'm a cop," I lied. "I can help you." She didn't reply. I said, "We can talk." She didn't reply. I let go of the grab bars and dropped my hands to my sides. It made me smaller, less threatening, just a guy. I stood as still as the moving train would let me. I did nothing. I had no option. She would need a split second. I would need more than that. Except that there was absolutely nothing I could do. I could have grabbed her bag and tried to tear it away from her, but it was looped around her body, and its strap was a wide band of tightly woven cotton, the same knit as a fire hose. It was pre-washed and pre-aged and pre-distressed like new stuff is now, but it would still be very strong. I would have ended up jerking her off her seat and dumping her down on the floor, except that I wouldn't have gotten anywhere near her. She would have hit the button before my hand was halfway there.
We hope you enjoyed this free preview of Gone Tomorrow, Book 13 in the Jack Reacher series. To keep the story going, get the complete book today.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.